Good morning. It's certainly good to be back with you again this morning, see everybody again. And we had talked last week as we were studying the birth of Christ. Am I on? Yeah, I'm turned on. Is your hearing aid on, Gary? Okay. We had talked as we studied the birth of Christ last week, and we said that we would consider the two genealogies of Jesus Christ this week. So I need to keep that promise. We need to take a look at them. As you're aware, there are two genealogies recorded. There's one in Matthew chapter 1, and then there's a second one in Luke chapter 3, right at the end of the chapter. Now, why are the genealogies of Jesus Christ important? I mean, we hit this section of the Bible, and we kind of run quick through it as quickly as we can. But why are the genealogies of Jesus Christ important? Yes, that's one reason. There's certainly the genealogies are important because they bring out the fact that Jesus Christ was a human. And as it's talking about that human aspect of his nature, or you look down the list of people who are in his ancestry, and it's certainly a mixed bag, is it not? You have some really great people, some godly people, some people that we would love in our lives if they could at least in some measure emulate them. And then you see others who are the scoundrels, as you look particularly through some of those kings of Judah. And you wonder, well, now, why would God include that person? You see, of course, they're mostly Jews, but every now and then there's a Gentile, such as Ruth the Moabitess, included in one of those lists. They're the ancestors who recorded are men, but there are some women who are recorded in that list as well. It's quite the mixed bag of the human race that are in that list, and God is pointing that out to us. But that's one reason why the genealogy is important, because it's showing and it's stressing that Jesus Christ did come in the flesh. He's not, as some of the Gnostics of the early centuries were proclaiming, that he was just a spirit who appeared to manifest himself and looked like a human being, but he was very God who came in the flesh. So for that reason, it's important. What's another reason that the genealogy, Kathy? To show that he was in the line of David, a very, very important reason. Can anyone think of any other reason why the genealogy? Evidence of the fulfillment of Scripture, specifically, the virgin born. We're going to hit some other prophecies this morning. Those are reasons. There was one other that I came up with as I was studying, that they proclaim that Jesus is born of a virgin. His father is truly God. Both of the genealogies, they'll go through list and list of man's names, and then they'll get down to Joseph, and they'll make it very clear that Joseph was not the biologic father of Jesus Christ. They proclaim that Jesus is born of a virgin. They proclaim that Jesus is not only God, but that he's human as well. And they proclaim that Jesus is a descendant of King David. For those reasons, they are important. Well, if it's important, why don't the two genealogies agree? If they're written by men, couldn't they have collaborated and gotten it right? And if it's written by God, which we believe it is, why did he record it one way in Matthew and another way in Luke? Before we get into the differences and reconciling them, I think we need to focus on what is important. Focusing on the differences is kind of negative. We need to do that. We need to reconcile them. But we lose the picture when we do that. God had a reason for recording it these ways, and we need to look at that and get that in mind, and then we'll take a look at reconciling some of these differences. The Matthew account, let's see, we have the Matthew account begins at Abraham. If you're in Matthew chapter 1, you'll notice that it starts with Abraham, and it moves downward through the generations, through David, and then to Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus. Matthew was written to the Jews. And the purpose of his gospel seems to be to he's presenting Jesus as the king. So as we look through his genealogy, it seems to be establishing the fact that Jesus has a legal right to claim the throne of David. It follows the royal line of the kings from David. From Old Testament scriptures, we see that sometimes Matthew will skip some generations, and biblical genealogies tend to do that from time to time. If you ever need evidence of that, this is a key passage. You can come to Matthew chapter 1. You can go back to 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, compare the list of kings, and you'll see that there are some names that are just skipped, omitted. There's some generations that are skipped. That's not a problem. The Greek word in the Matthew passage is genao, or begat. It means physical procreation. You were to take a DNA sample. Who's the biologic daddy? This is the biologic daddy. That's what genao, or begat, means. It's very specific that it's tracing the physical line of Joseph's ancestry, but Joseph, as the scriptures have pointed out, was not the father of Jesus. So this would establish Jesus' legal claim to the throne of David, but not his physical line of human ancestry. The Luke account. I mean, it's like God is just sort of emphasizing how different he's doing it, because instead of starting with the oldest generation working to the newest, in the Luke account he starts with the newest and works his way back to the oldest. He starts with Joseph, works his way, this is at the end of Luke chapter 3, starts with Joseph, works his way back up through the generations, through David, through Abraham, keeps on going past Abraham to Adam, called the Son of God. Luke was written to the Gentiles, and Luke's purpose was to trace Jesus' human lineage back to Adam, the father of the entire human race. Later, in the epistle to the Romans, we'll see that Jesus is compared and contrasted to Adam. He's called the second Adam. From David onward, this genealogy comes down through an otherwise obscure son of David named Nathan. So the Luke genealogy also presents Christ as a descendant of David. Luke is presenting Jesus as the sinless man, the Savior for all humanity. And he stresses his humanity and his inclusion of the entire human race. Well, difference in theme does not, allow for one genealogy being correct and the other one being at best incorrect, or at worst, something that was fabricated by the writer to support his theme. It's good for us to know. The more important thing for us to know is the theme of each genealogy and what the Holy Spirit is trying to communicate to us through that passage. But if you've got a difference like this, you need to at least address it, and if it's possible, to reconcile where you can. Where do the genealogies differ? Well, from Adam to Abraham, there's no problem. Matthew doesn't list that. Luke does, but Matthew doesn't. So no problem, Adam to Abraham. Abraham to David, no problem. There's a few little differences here and there, but they're easily explained, generations being skipped, or, one man, some people might call Dean, and other people might call him Frank, we have people, that happens, So that's not a problem, especially when you're translating names from one language to another. David to Joseph, that's where we have the problems. As I indicated, Matthew starts with David's son Solomon and takes the lineage. Luke starts with Nathan and goes down another line. That's easy enough to consider that. But when you get right down to Joseph, who's Joseph's father? I mean, Matthew says it's one person. Luke says it's another. How do you reconcile that? Over the past few weeks, I've read at least 10 different proposed explanations, and none of them are without the problems. The greatest being that you have to go outside the text, and to some extent you have to go into some speculation to explain the difference. The best explanation seems to be that Matthew is the genealogy of Joseph, and Luke seems to present the genealogy of Mary. Okay, now why would we say that? You go right there to Luke. It says Eli, the father of Joseph. The reason for this, again, you have to go outside the text, and there is some speculation, is that we know Jesus had to be physically descended from David to fulfill the prophecy that the Messiah would be a son of David. The only and Matthew is very specific that this is the physical lineage of Joseph, and he's also establishing the legal claim to the throne. But the only human parent that Jesus had would be Mary. So if you're going to trace the lineage, you have to trace it through Mary. Well, why does it say that Eli is the son of Joseph? Whereas Matthew is very specific about physical descent with the term gnao or beget, the language of Luke is weaker. When you see all these lists of, I mean, in your translation, they'll vary how it says it, but a lot of them will say so-and-so, the son of somebody. That's not how it's written in the Greek. It would actually say, like, which of Aminadab or whomever. So it's really saying that this person was of the house or the family or the lineage of that other person. It's a much weaker term. It allows for adoptions. It allows for Levirate marriages, somebody being somebody's uncle. It's just a lot looser term. The best explanation would seem to be that Eli was Joseph's father-in-law, and that he would have then been Mary's father. And this would be a line of Mary that's being traced backwards, which is, okay, easy enough. But then you have a real problem right in the middle between David and Joseph. There are two names that are the same. There's Zerubbabel and his father Shealtiel. Anybody remember who Zerubbabel was? Jeff, do you remember any guy named Zerubbabel? Who was this Zerubbabel? Right, when the Jews returned from captivity in Babylon, he was the leader, and he was prominent in the post-exile time, and he was of the line of the kings. So whatever explanation you have going on for reconciling the two fathers of Joseph, you have to come up with some explanation for there being two different fathers listed for Shealtiel. And again, they get very creative, particularly when it comes to Levirate marriages, which would have been one man. If a man died without any children, his brother would marry the widow and raise up children in his deceased brother's name. So there's some very elaborate family trees that are concocted to help reconcile this. And as I say, you have to get into some speculation, but there are explanations out there. There's plenty of them. Just pick up any commentary or any study Bible, and you'll get some good theories and explanations. I mentioned the Harmony of the Gospels that we're using as a kind of background for this class has a very good essay in it explaining at least one possible family tree that could reconcile these. Well, whatever explanation might, and of all the explanations that have been proposed, they might all be wrong. But we know that somehow they're both correct. And whatever explanation might be to reconcile the two, we know that they're both correct, and we must not allow the differences to distract us from the main points of the overall message of the genealogies, which are that they proclaim Jesus is born of a virgin, his Father is God. They proclaim that not only is Jesus God, but he's also human as well. And they proclaim Jesus as a descendant of King David. Well, with that, let's turn in our Bibles to Matthew chapter 2, which Rod read the first 12 verses to us this morning. And there's two things. This story records the visit of the wise men or the visit of the Magi. And I'll use both terms back and forth, no doubt, through the class. There's two things that seem to be running through this whole account. I mentioned to you before, it's always struck me as odd that the gospel written to the Gentiles, which was Luke, recorded the announcement of Jesus' birth to the Jewish shepherds. So the gospel to the Gentiles recorded the announcement to the Jewish. And the gospel written to the Jews, Matthew, records the announcement to the Gentile Magi. Always struck me as odd. But I think what God is doing here is showing to the Jewish people, he's laying the groundwork for the Messiah was rejected by the Jews, even at his birth. You know, from his birth he was rejected, but the Gentiles came and worshipped. He's laying the groundwork or the foundation for that. The other theme that runs through the passage is you see repeated again and again the phrase, that the prophecy might be fulfilled. Or the writer is very careful not to use those words. And it changes, but it's usually something that the word of the Lord spoken through the prophet might be fulfilled. Slight distinction there, but it's much shorter to write it, that the prophecy might be fulfilled. But again, throughout the passage, it just keeps on coming back to that. So that's going to be the thing that we're looking at, are these prophecies that the writer says were fulfilled. Rod read through it for us, verses 1 through 12, so we won't repeat them. The first misconception that we have to correct is that the Magi arrived on the night Jesus was born. Jesus had to be at least 6 weeks old, because according to Luke, he was presented at the temple when he was 40 days old, and his parents were poor. They didn't have enough money to buy a lamb. They had to go with doves. If the gifts of the Magi had been there, they would have certainly bought a lamb to use for Mary's sacrifice. But more importantly than that, as soon as the Magi left, they had to hightail it out of town and go to Egypt, as we'll see. So he had to have been at least 6 weeks old. The events that he had been presented at the temple as required by the law, and the Magi came sometime after that. We don't think he was much more than a year old, but we just don't have a good, peg on the time frame there. Another misconception is that there were three of them. The Bible doesn't tell us how many. And all the commentators make a big point of this. Well, I'm going to break theologic and biblical ground here because I know how many. Because I got this Christmas card. I can count them. One, two, three. And I know one of them's named Casper, and the other one, I think Herman and Mo. I forget. But, that's our tradition. Tradition, we think three because of the three gifts. But, of course, we don't know how many there were. Who are the Magi, or the wise men? They're astrologers or astronomers from the East, probably Persia or Babylon. Now, what is the first question that pops into your mind when you get to this part of the account? You probably, if you ever heard the story as a child sitting in Sunday school class, or, this is probably a thing that you either asked the teacher or sat there and wanted to ask the teacher. What's the first question pops in your mind? How did they know? Yeah. Okay, a star appears in the east. Somehow they associated that there's a king born of the Jews. We don't know. But somehow God had revealed to these Gentiles, these stargazers, that his son had been born. But they did come and they did worship. Let's talk about this word worship that appears here in Matthew 2. Every time you see the word worship here in Matthew chapter 2, The Greek word is proskuneo, worship. It doesn't mean just acknowledging that someone is greater than you, like you might acknowledge your boss, or you might acknowledge the President of the United States. You know, we have respect for him because he is elected the president. He is in the office. And whether we like him or not, we respect the office. Or maybe we respect the CEO of our company, whether we know him or not. He's the boss, and for that reason, we respect him. It doesn't mean to just show them honor. It does mean showing honor, but overriding the honor is adoration. Just total love for that person. It means to bow down and prostrate oneself before another to pay homage. Have you ever had anyone come running up to you and just throw themselves down to the ground and bury their face in the dirt and throw their hands out in front of you or in front of themselves? Doesn't happen much in America. But it means to do that, but to also fawn and to adore that person. The etymology of the word even has in it the picture of a dog. And what do the Jews call the Gentiles? They call them dogs. So here's Matthew writing to the Jews and talking about these Gentiles, and here's this word that he's using. It has the picture of a dog licking his master's hand. I mean, that's just the total worship, the adoration that they have. It's reserved for a deity. So here we have these Gentiles, somehow in recognition of who Jesus really is and a heart of true worship toward him. As J.C. Ryle states it, God has his followers in places we may not think to look for them. By means that are unknown to us, he gets his truth to them. And out of the biblical pages steps completely by surprise a Melchizedek, you know, who's a priest of God that where's he coming from? You know, all of a sudden here he is in this otherwise pagan Canaanite town, and he's the king of it, and he's a priest of God. Or we have Jethro, who was Moses' father-in-law, a priest of Midian. Or we have these Gentiles, these Magi, who somehow God has revealed truth to them, and they have responded to that truth, and they have a heart of true worship toward him. The wise men asked in Jerusalem for the one who had been born king of the Jews. They didn't think to go to the visitor center. They figure, why, this must be a big event. Everybody knows this. Just stop the first kid you see on the street. He can tell you where the king of the Jews is. So they ask, where is he who's been born king of the Jews? Word gets to Herod. Herod had not been born a king. They're asking for the one who had been born the king of the Jews. Herod had not been born a king. He had been appointed to the post by the Romans. And he was not a Jew. He was an Idumean. Anybody know what an Idumean was, or any clue? Yes, he was a descendant of Esau. He was an Edomite. For some reason, by the time the first century rolled around, they had quit calling them Edomites. They had been displaced from their homeland, which was southeast of the Dead Sea, and now they were south of Judah. But they started calling them Idumeans, not even a Jew. So, and what had God said about Edomites? We studied the Old Testament, the Minor Prophets. Book of Obadiah had something to say about Edomites, and the Book of Malachi had something to say about them. Anybody remember anything God said about those Edomites? I don't remember that passage, but I do remember in Obadiah, it said that the Edomites would be brought down, and they would be thoroughly slaughtered. And again, in Malachi, he said, against the Edomites, his indignation would forever be. Herod could easily be threatened by one who was born the king of the Jews, even if he was just a little baby. Now, this King Herod was Herod the Great. He ruled from 37 B.C. to 4 B.C., and he undertook building projects. So Jeff talked to us last week or 2 weeks ago about some of these great building projects that Herod had done, and you could see the ruins of them today. And really, it boggles our imagination to even begin to think of and discuss all these tremendous and magnificent projects that Herod undertook. We think of him in terms of the temple. He did start the building of the temple. It took like 50 or 60 years after he died to finish it. But that was just one. That was just really one of the smaller ones that he did. And just all over Judea and the land of Palestine, he had these huge civil work projects. And even outside of the area of his realm, he financed building of projects. He was an incredible builder. But he was incredibly ruthless. From historical accounts, we know that he had already murdered his wife, three sons, his mother-in-law, his brother-in-law, his uncle, many others. So when Herod was troubled, you can understand the next few words, and all Jerusalem with him. When Herod wasn't happy, wasn't nobody going to be happy. You know, he was that kind of guy. In verse 6, Matthew gets to the prophetic point that Jesus was born in Bethlehem as foretold by prophecy. The first part of that quote is from Micah 5:2, written more than 700 years prior, and the second part is from God's promise to David in 2 Samuel 5:21, which had been made 1,000 years earlier. From the chief priest, we see that head knowledge does not assure a right heart before God, does it? These men knew the prophecy. They didn't have to say, can we get back to you on that? Can I go look that up? They knew right from the top of their head that that the Messiah was to be born in Bethlehem. I have to always wonder a little bit. From Luke, we know that the shepherds went and talked about what they had seen, and surely some word must have gotten back to Jerusalem. There must have been some talk. You know, even without the internet, word went around, you know, urban legends. Did you hear about this? Yeah, I heard about it. I don't believe it. Or, yeah, I heard about it. But at least some talk must have happened, must have gotten back to Jerusalem. Apparently it never got to Herod. But I can see I would not want to be the person bringing that news to him. Come to think of it, I wouldn't want to be the person who kept it from him if he found out I kept it. Anyway, they didn't have to go. These chief priests did not have to go look up the prophecy. They knew it. When Herod demanded of them to know where the Messiah was to be born, they could tell it without referencing. But it didn't get down to their heart. Whereas the wise men, with less biblical knowledge than the Jews, had traveled hundreds of miles, and they had braved desert, rivers, bandits, and more to come worship the Messiah, the chief priest, who knew the prophecy by heart, didn't wander 6 miles down the road to check it out, to worship or at least to investigate this report of a newborn Messiah. Now, most commentators will attribute this to apathy in their hearts. I'm not excusing their lack of action, but I think it's more due to fear of Herod, that they didn't want Herod getting wind that they had gone down to check out a newborn king. Well, the star that the wise men followed, as we continue the passage, was no ordinary star. It was no convergence of natural events. It moved before the wise men after they left Herod, and it led them to the very house where Jesus was. And the verse says, when they saw the star, they rejoiced. The Greek here, and we try to translate it, and I think really the translators could have done better here. But you, to word for word go in the Greek, it says rejoiced, great, exceeding. It's just hard to communicate how thrilled they were when, as they left Jerusalem, they saw that star again. They rejoiced with exceeding great joy. And even that doesn't quite communicate, I think, what the writer was saying. Verse 11, notice one interesting feature about the structure of the wording in this passage. It says, the child with Mary, his mother. Whenever Jesus is mentioned in the same context as his mother Mary in the scriptural account, Jesus is always mentioned first. The emphasis is on Jesus. He is the prominent figure when you put Jesus and his mother Mary. Now, as man, we often get that reversed, and we flip the side of the coin there, as we often do. But Scripture has Jesus always the prominent feature there. The wise men came, and they brought gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh, and they worshipped. And there was that word again, they worshipped Jesus. And Isaiah 60 speaks of Gentiles coming when Jesus comes and we have the millennial kingdom. Isaiah 60 talks about Gentiles coming to worship Jesus, and they're going to bring two of these same three gifts. Okay, the three gifts are gold, frankincense, myrrh. But Isaiah 60 doesn't mention the third of these. You want to guess which one of the three Gentiles are not going to be bringing? I hear one gold. I hear several myrrhs. James, why would we? Well, let me tell about gold and frankincense, and then I'll let you tell why we would not be bringing myrrh. Or gold, you know, it's the most precious of metals. It's for a king. It's highly valued for its warm beauty. It's enduring. It never rusts. It never loses its beauty. You can bring artifacts, golden artifacts out that were made centuries or millennia ago, and they're still just beautiful. Frankincense is a perfume. It's used. It was used in worship. You know, it was incense. What was myrrh, James? It was burial. It was used for several things. It was a spice. Kind of had a lot of the same origins as frankincense, but it was a spice. It was medicine. It's bitter. And there's, you remember, what was Ruth's mother-in-law? She said, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara," which means bitterness. Very, very much the same root word, myrrh, the bitterness there. There's only two other times where myrrh is talked about in the Gospels. One of them is Mark 15:23, when Jesus was on the cross. He was offered wine mixed with myrrh as a drug to deaden the pain. It was a medicine of some sort, but he didn't take it. And in John 19:38 and following, we see it used in the context that James was talking about, that Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, when they took the body and they prepared the body of Jesus for burial, they wrapped it in linen cloths and they brought 75 pounds of aloe and myrrh to wrap the body in accordance with the custom of the Jews. So when Gentiles in the millennial kingdom bring gold and frankincense to Jesus, they will be worshiping and adoring him. But the Gentiles are not going to be bringing him myrrh. He doesn't need it. There's not going to be any need for medicine, and there's never going to be a time, again, when his body has to be prepared for burial. So they brought him the gold, the frankincense, and the myrrh. And then, being warned in a dream, the wise men depart another way. Being warned in a dream not to go back to Herod. Now, Matthew records five instances here associated with the birth of Jesus where God communicated with man by having an angel appear to him in a dream. First, we studied last week, angel appeared to Joseph in a dream, said, "Take Mary to be your wife." This is the second. The angel appears to the wise men in a dream, "Don't go back to Herod." There'll be three more in the account this morning. Well, that's the first prophecy that was fulfilled, that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. The second, verses 13 and 15, is that God would call his son from Egypt. Let me read verses 13 and 15. "Now when they," the Magi, "had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying," arise, that would be the third time God appeared to someone in a dream, "saying, arise and take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him. And he arose and took the child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that what was spoken," here's the reason why this happened, "that what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet might be fulfilled, saying, out of Egypt did I call myself? Again, we see the picture of Joseph being a man obedient to God. He did what God told him to do. Now, why did Joseph leave by night? Anybody ever think about that? Why did he leave by night? It was hot. It's cooler to travel at night. The kids would sleep. No. No. He was sneaking out. Yeah, he was sneaking out. There was the immediacy of it. We can presume that, you know, he got up from his sleep, he had the dream, and he may not have, for all he knew, the soldiers were on their way right then. He wanted to get up in the middle of the night, bundle up the family, take the gifts of the Magi, pack a few meager belongings, and head for Egypt. There was also the cover of darkness from the soldiers. He didn't know if the soldiers were already on the way, and obviously, soldiers, anybody else, they can't see as well at night. And if you're on the road or whatever path you're taking, harder to be distinguished, easier to hide in the nighttime than in the daytime. But also for secrecy and safety. To hide actually even from those in Bethlehem. He didn't want, you know, the soldiers were going to be asking about them, and he didn't want to have to answer any questions about where he was going. Didn't want anybody saying, well, they took off down this road going that way. It was sneaking out in the middle of the night. We presume he paid his bill, but he left in the middle of the night for immediacy, for safety, and for secrecy. And again, verse 15 tells us the purpose of all these events, in verses 13, 14, and 15, would be that the prophecy would be fulfilled. Out of Egypt did I call my son. The prophecy that he would be referring to would have been spoken in Hosea, chapter 11, verse 1. Well, the third prophecy would be that there would be great weeping in Ramah for lost children, verses 16 through 18. Then when Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he became very enraged and sent and slew all the male children who were in Bethlehem and all its environs from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had ascertained for the Magi. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled, saying, a voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and she refused to be comforted because they were no more. Herod slowly realized that the Magi were not returning to Jerusalem, and his reaction was to become very enraged, and he ordered a slaughter of the male little boys in and around Bethlehem. So far as the timing of the slaughter, or the time, he put geographic and time limitations on it. The time limitations were 2 years old and younger. Now that from the time he ascertained from the Magi, the route they took, if it was a commercial route, would have taken them at least 40 days to get from the region of Babylon or Persia over to Jerusalem, and it also would have taken some time to get ready for the trip. So we can just imagine that Herod said to the Magi, oh, when did you see this star? And one of the Magi said, oh, about a year ago we saw it. And so Herod just kept that in his mind, and being the type of person that he was, he just said, figuring that the child may have been a year old, he said, kill them all, 2 years, double it, you know, just 2 years and younger, kill them all. And note that the soldiers weren't asking for birth dates. They weren't checking birth certificates. If the child looked like he was 2 years old or younger, kill him. And if you were reporting to the kind of man that Herod was, you would go above that limit. Well, the prophecy also had some the command from Herod has some geographic limits to it. He said, Bethlehem and its environs, kill them. Now, the prophecy talks about there being weeping in Ramah. Bethlehem was about six to eight miles to the southeast of Jerusalem. Ramah was about 6 to 8 miles to the northeast. So that was a pretty big area. It wasn't just the little town of Bethlehem where the babies were slaughtered. It was a significant area there where those children were slaughtered. Rachel weeping for her children refused to be comforted because they were no more. Rachel was Jacob's favored wife. She's often spoken of as being the mother of all Israel. her tomb was near Bethlehem. And so that's what it means when Rachel was weeping for her children. Now, as despicable as this act is, the fact that Herod knew that he was attempting to put to death the Lord's anointed makes the sin all the worse. The next prophecy, the Messiah would be called a Nazarene, verses 19 to 23. But when Herod was dead, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, "Arise, take the child and his mother, and go into the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead." And he arose and took the child and his mother, and came into the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And being warned by God in a dream, he departed for the regions of Galilee, and came and resided in a city called Nazareth, that what was spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled: he shall be called a Nazarene. The final fulfilled prophecy is that he would be called a Nazarene. And also in this passage, we see the final two times when God warned Joseph through a dream. Now, where was it prophesied that Jesus would be called a Nazarene? This is where it gets difficult, because there's no direct Old Testament prophecy that says that. And one possibility might be that there were some verbal prophecies that just didn't get recorded. Maybe that's what Matthew is referring to there. Or it may be that Nazareth, in Matthew's mind, was synonymous with meaning despised or insignificant. It was a small town, about 70 miles north of Jerusalem. And in fact, when Philip came up to Nathanael in John chapter 1 and said, "We have found the Messiah, he is Jesus of Nazareth," what was Nathanael's response? Can anything good come out of Nazareth? So it may be that he was using Nazareth or a Nazarene to be synonymous with something who was despised, insignificant. If that's the case, you know, there might be prophecies in mind such as Isaiah 53:3. "He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hid their face." Or Psalm 22, speaking of the Messiah and his death on the cross, it says, "But I am a worm, not a man, a reproach of men, despised by the people. For all who see me sneer at me, they separate with the lip, they wag the head." That would probably be the more accurate of what Matthew had in mind here when he said that Jesus would be called a Nazarene, that it would be something that's despised and insignificant. Well, that's Matthew chapter 2. Let's flip over just real quickly and take a look at the last event from the early years of Jesus Christ. Luke chapter 2, verses 39 to 52. And this is the story of when Joseph and Mary took Jesus with them to Jerusalem to the feast. He was 12 years old. Anyone want to give us a real quick summary of that story? Just quickly, real quick. I know you've heard this story before. Don't be shy. Yes, Jake, I see your hand.
Jesus was in the temple and his parents left out, and they thought he was with someone else, but they found out he wasn't. So they went back, and then Jesus was there talking to people in the temple, and they were greatly amazed by what he did.
Perfect. That's exactly what happened. Now, when you think of all the things that aren't recorded, you have to ask yourself in the Bible, particularly in the life of Christ, you have to ask yourself, when something is recorded, why did God record that for us? Why did he take the time to in the pages and the ink to record that? We have only one biblical account, and thus only one accurate, reliable account, of the boyhood of Jesus Christ, or of his life entirely, from his birth all the way up until he started ministry at about age 30. This is the only story we have. So what is God trying to tell us about this story? It's a neat story. It's a fun story. I love it, you know. What is the point in this story for us? Well, There's a couple of big words that I think this story really addresses, and it kind of lies at the heart of this story. And as you're thinking what the purpose of Luke was when he was writing his gospel and why he recorded it, the first big word is hypostatic union. Keith, what does hypostatic union mean? In words I can understand, third grade. Exactly. He's completely God, he's completely man. How do those two natures exist in one person? The hypostatic union. The other is kenosis. Who has heard the word, at least heard the word kenosis before? You've heard the word kenosis. Okay. I see a few. Michael, what is kenosis? Just real simple. What's kenosis mean? The emptying out of oneself. And the reason we have that in relation to Christ comes from Philippians chapter 2, verse 7, where it speaks of he emptied out himself and took upon himself the form of a man. Okay. Now, if you've never heard those words or you never knew the definition, don't worry about it. Because even people who know the definitions, not picking on anybody, I'm talking about anybody out there who knows the definitions, nobody understands the concept. Nobody can fully grasp either of these concepts. We can't fully grasp how Jesus can be completely God and completely man. And we really struggle with, well, what does it mean that he emptied himself? But this passage deals with those big words of the hypostatic union and the kenosis. And what it's telling us about what the story tells us about those big words and about Jesus Christ is that just as Jesus' physical body matured, so did his intellect. We read verse 40. And the child, Luke chapter 2, verse 40, and the child, speaking of Jesus as he was a young child, right after his, from his infancy, the child continued to grow and to become strong, increasing in wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him. Just as his physical body matured, so did his intellect. And we also see in verse 52, from the age 12 and older, and Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. So it says it twice in this passage, verse 40 and verse 52. He had to learn how to walk and talk and do all the other things that a human being had to learn. The second thing we see from the passage is that even though his wisdom was increasing, it wasn't extraordinary. Now, he did have the divine aspect of his nature, but somehow he chose to limit that. We don't fully understand it, either how he did it or the extent or the limits, but we know that he did. But I believe in large part the reason his wisdom was so extraordinary that he was confounding the aged men at the temple with his questions. And by the way, this was a very normal way for learning to happen back then. It was, he did the responsible thing. He got left behind. Go to some place where your parents can find you. Sit there. Stay out of trouble. And it was very appropriate for a young man to sit and ask questions of the aged teachers. They were amazed at his wisdom. I think a large degree of that is because he was not encumbered by a sin nature such as we are. So even though his wisdom was increasing, it was extraordinary, we see that Jesus was aware that God was his Father. When did he become aware of this? We don't know. But somehow he knew, he was aware that God was his Father. He said, "Did you not know that I would be about my Father's business?" And we see that Jesus, though he was God, was in subjection to his earthly parents. Well, that's a lot of territory that we covered this morning. We covered two genealogies of Jesus Christ. We covered the visit of the Magi. We covered the visit of Jesus to the temple when he was 12 years old. Covering the early years of Jesus Christ. As we look at those passages in a whole, what facts can we learn about Jesus' life? These facts from the early years of Jesus' life proclaim to us that he is indeed the Messiah that just was brought out time and time again. This is the promised one. You've been looking for him ever since Genesis chapter 3. They proclaim that he is fully God and he is fully man. And although we can't fully comprehend that, we can fully believe it. And they proclaim to us that he is worthy to be worshipped. And that lays the groundwork for the rest of the Gospels, in which we will be spending the rest of this year. And Jeff will start us next week with the ministry of John the Baptist.